This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We get wise and happy as a result by having experience in doing the right thing. And so that applies to judges, to the judicial system, to doctors, the medical system, to professors and the educational system, but it also applies to cooks and eaters.
Feeling peckish? No living creature can live without nourishment, but feeding ourselves conscientiously requires a little research. This week on Sea Change Radio, we dig into the archives as journalist Georgina Gustin tells us about the troubling agenda of the Farm Bureau, one of the most powerful lobbying organizations in the country. Then we revisit our discussion with author and food expert Gigi Berardi as she lays out ways to make better decisions about what we eat. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Georgina Gustin. She's a reporter at Inside Climate News. Georgina, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So, Georgina, you and your colleagues, Neela Banerjee and John Cushman, recently published a four-part series on the Farm Bureau and the big effect it has on not only our food system, but in politics as well. First off, what exactly is the Farm Bureau?
Yeah, the Farm Bureau is the country's largest agricultural lobbying group. It claims about 6 million members, and it's a very forceful political force, and it represents American farmers on the Hill and in Congress, sort of the halls of Congress, but it also has a large insurance component, and that's where it derives a lot of its funds from. And so it's a not-for-profit on one side and then has a for-profit network of insurance companies. And I think why a lot of people are confused about what the Farm Bureau is because they hear things like State Farm and farmers insurance. And in fact, once long ago, that was linked to the Farm Bureau kind of tangentially, but now it's really just an agricultural lobbying organization and a very powerful one.
And it's one that you and your colleagues believe is not only failing farmers, but failing the planet in terms of addressing the realities of climate change. The title of the first entry in the series is How the Farm Bureau's Climate Agenda is Failing Farmers. So in a nutshell, what is the Farm Bureau's climate agenda?
Well, it doesn't have a climate agenda, except historically or in the last 30 years, its agenda has been to scuttle any kind of regulations or law that would have any meaningful impact on climate change. And the reason we started looking into the Farm Bureau is because, as I mentioned, it's the biggest lobbying group representing farmers. And we thought it was really interesting that this very potent group seemed to us to be working against the best interests of the people it represents, because agriculture is not just a contributor to climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, but is also agriculture also has a huge potential for solving the climate crisis. And when we started looking into how the Farm Bureau had behaved in terms of pushing legislation or working against regulation, we realized that it was basically thwarting any positive action, any ability for farmers to contribute to meaningfully to the climate challenge or to do anything about it.
And we often look at some of the alternative agricultural methods here on Sea Change Radio, which should give us all hope for a better way to grow our food. But then when we learn about the Farm Bureau's power and its lengthy history of opposing climate change-related policies and advocating for industrial agriculture and fossil fuels, it's quite disheartening, to say the least. How does the Farm Bureau represent its members? What do you think the average farmer might think about the Farm Bureau?
Well, that's a good question, and it's kind of complicated. The Farm Bureau claims 6 million member families, which is kind of an ill-defined idea. And there are only 2 million farms in America, so the numbers don't really work. But it derives a lot of its power from that big number. In any case, farmers, there is not a one size fits all, but I think in the case of the Farm Bureau, a lot of its farm members, you would maybe kind of categorize in this sort of conventional large scale corn and bean and commodity producer. That's how you would define them. For the most part, these aren't small, diversified farms. And you're right, there is a lot of really great stuff being done on American farms, including on some what you would call industrial scale farms. There, more people are cover cropping, there's less tillage, but for the most part, you have farms getting bigger and more consolidation in the industry. And that is the trend that the Farm Bureau has pushed. And that's kind of who it represents. It's the big agricultural sort of forces at work, I guess I would put it that way. It doesn't directly represent big industrial agriculture corporations, but the style of agriculture that it advocates ends up supporting those companies.
Maybe you can outline how government policy hasn't really helped small farmers either. How have subsidies torpedoed some of the positive changes that are being made by some in the agricultural space?
That's a good question. And there are kind of big and small ways that this happens. But for a small example would be, in order to qualify for subsidized crop insurance, you need to start planting at a certain time. And that means getting rid of your cover crop, which is something you plant in the fall that keeps the soil in place over the winter. And you have to, at a certain point, you have to terminate that cover crop, and you have to do it by a certain date. And we were hearing, or have heard, of a lot of farmers losing their crop insurance subsidy because they were planting cover crops and they weren't terminating them at the right time, or they were confused about when they were supposed to terminate them. And so a lot of farmers just don't bother with these really good practices for fear that they're going to lose insurance and lose their insurance subsidy or be disqualified altogether. So that's just one small way. I think people are more comfortable with the status quo and introducing these new sort of approaches, but introducing them into the status quo, adds a layer of complexity that puts them at risk of losing their subsidies.
So, Georgina, looking in greater detail at some of the work of the Farm Bureau over the years, it's sort of odd how active they've been in fighting environmental efforts, from trying to abolish the EPA in 1980 to advocating for drilling in Anwar in Alaska in 1987 to being one of the keys to ruining the Kyoto Protocol in the late 90s. These don't seem to be agriculture-related issues to me, but the Farm Bureau doesn't seem set on staying in its lane, does it?
Yeah, you're right. They do seem to stray from what you might consider strictly agricultural issues, but agriculture is reliant on fossil fuels. So when you think about fuel that needs to power tractors and energy resources required to run a farming operation, it makes sense that they would fall in line with the petroleum industry's position and lobbying efforts. And then there are some things that you might not think about, like fertilizer is essentially a converted form of natural gas, and farms use a lot of fertilizer. So it's not just the hewing to the traditional conservative positions. There's practical and economic alignment too that you might not think about. So it has dovetailed interests with the fossil fuel industry, and they make natural allies, actually.
And it seems like one of the Bureau's most popular lines is to resort to telling people that all of their efforts keep food prices low, so consumers should just blindly go along with whatever the Farm Bureau is advocating for unless they want higher food prices. Is that really the case, though?
Yeah, that's a pretty common refrain that you hear. And I should say that, first of all, much of the agriculture that the Farm Bureau has come to work with and for isn't actually producing food. It's producing ethanol that goes into gas tanks. It's producing, you know, corn ethanol. It's producing high fructose corn syrup, and it's producing animal feed. So this whole claim that we're feeding, you know, we need all of this support because we have to feed the world, is kind of a trope that they've relied on quite a bit. And I mean, I think this whole idea that your food prices will go up is just it's a handy one-liner, I think, and economists can tease it apart a lot better than I can. But I would say that that's just, generally a memorable thing to say to gain political traction, or to not gain political traction, as the case is.
If you see something that looks like a star shooting up off of the ground, and your head is spinning from a loud guitar, and you can't escape from the sound, don't worry too much, it'll happen to you. We were children once playing with toys, and the thing that you're hearing is only the sound and low spark of high heel boys. Yeah. High heel boys.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Georgina Gustin. She's a reporter at Inside Climate News. So, Georgina, could we cripple the power of the Farm Bureau by changing the way we insure farmers? Because we're talking about them facing droughts and flooding and other effects of climate change. There's a system in place that insulates them somewhat from the near-term effects, but doesn't really take into account long-term planning. And the insurance system has allowed them to calcify in terms of setting forth solution-oriented policies. I guess the question is then, is there a way to transform the insurance payout system to link agriculture to climate change, to get them on board with this?
Yeah, that's a really complicated question. But essentially what you have is an insurance system heavily subsidized by the government that pays farmers for crop losses or financial losses. And because they are protected, I mean, they pay into the system too, but because it's largely subsidized, a lot of economists believe that farmers continue to plant in ways that are risky because they're going to be covered. And so there's nothing incentivizing them from taking conservation and climate-oriented steps on their farms, which are expensive and time-consuming, or more expensive and time-consuming. So the insurance piece of this is really important, and it's complicated. The Farm Bureau has long advocated for a robust crop insurance system. And that means that farmers continue to farm in risky ways, and they continue to plant the same thing year after year, because that's just the system that's in place. And that system happens to be a very resource intensive system that doesn't maximize the climate benefits that these farms could add. And if they were to, within that system, incentivize different kinds of farming, in different farming practices, I think that would go a long way towards changing the way that farmers do things.
Georgina Gustin is a reporter at Inside Climate News. Georgina, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Gigi Berardi. She's a professor of food studies and geography at Western Washington University, and her new book is Food Wise. Gigi, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
So you have a new book coming out entitled Food Wise. What is the WISE approach? It's an acronym. Why don't you explain to our listeners what the WISE approach to sourcing and preparing meals is all about?
Right. WISE is an acronym, and the acronym is WHOLE for W, informed is the I, S is sustainable, and E is experience. So experience-based thinking. And I had thought about using WISE EST, and that would have allowed me to add a T for tasty, but I did not. And so in its simplest form, it represents an approach to dealing with food choices. So this book is a little different in that it's not about food so much as about food choices, which are really difficult for many of us to make.
So is it for consumers who are going to the store shopping and the choices that they have to make when they get home?
Precisely.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you think that consumers are facing in today's marketplace?
Time and money. In particular, I mean, I think people can choose wisely and find inexpensive foods and inexpensive ways to cook, but then it comes down to time, and that is, you know, valuing time, the time it takes to cook, to prepare a meal, to invite friends over, and to be hospitable. So I think that time is a real limiting factor. And I should say that when I wrote this book, I was really trying to address my students, as well as friends, family, colleagues, and other people I work with. And students are very busy with school and also are on tight budgets. And so they find it very difficult to find the time and money. But to cook. But in one of my classes, we've got 150 students, and part of the class is cooking for a potluck. So we have potlucks with 150 students, and 50 students cook at a time. So it's experience in trying to cook well, tasty foods on a budget.
So what would you want chefs and diners alike to take away from the WISE acronym?
Well, that's a good question, because I designed the acronym to be kind of all-encompassing. Kind of, you don't need anything else except to remember this acronym when you're shopping. And so the W stands for WHOLE, and that's whole farm systems and whole foods. And so that gets us away from a lot of so-called processed foods. And in terms of whole farm systems, in the book, that really means systems that are able to produce their own fertility, the nutrients that they need to produce foods, either from animal sources or from plants in terms of cover crops. It also means, in terms of whole farm systems, farms on a scale that matter and contribute to community. So that can include quite large farms, as it often does for organic products. We talk about big organic. As long as those farms are contributing to community. So that's the whole farm piece. And then the whole foods are, well, Michael Pollan, another food writer, talks about foods your grandmother or grandfather would recognize. But we're trying to stay away from foods that are so processed that they're high in nutrients that we don't really need. And usually that means polyunsaturated fats, so processed fats. So trying to stay away from that. So that's the whole piece. I is being informed as much as possible about what I just talked about. And S is sustainable. And what you want to do is choose foods that are coming from sustainable systems, which invariably means whole food and whole farm systems, but also sustainable economically for the individual shopper. And then E is experience. So you want to go with foods that you know something about or you're willing to get some experience on. And the reason why that's so important is the more experience we have, then the wiser we get, literally. So I made up the acronym, but one of the main themes of the book comes from a sociologist and a political scientist at Swarthmore who wrote a book called Practical Wisdom. And the main thesis of that book is that we get wise and happy as a result by having experience and doing the right thing. And so that applies to judges, to the judicial system, to doctors, the medical system, to professors and the educational system, but it also applies to cooks and eaters.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking with Gigi Berardi. Her new book is called Food Wise.
Let's take a scenario of a busy father of two who's supposed to be cooking dinner that night, and he's got very limited time and a limited budget, and lives kind of in a food desert. There's no Whole Foods within a few miles of him. He's not going to the farmer's market to pick out the best tomatoes in the county. He's in a pretty limited grocery store, and it's 6 o'clock at night. He's got two hungry kids waiting for him. Walk us through some choices that he might make in reality, and in the future, what kind of choices you're hoping, if he has read Food-Wise, what kind of choices he might make instead.
Well, I think in terms of the time scale, there's past, present, and future. So if we could just look at past for a minute, you know, part of Food-Wise is planning too. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, making up a big pot of rice, you know, of brown rice in advance. And I mean, this is what I do. And I go to the supermarket, to the deli, and I might get some roasted vegetables or other vegetables and add that to my rice. In the future, there's no substitute for planning like that. And you can, you know, canned foods are very inexpensive. And so there's quite a number of canned foods which don't have preservatives in them, in part because they are fairly high in salt. But you can always rinse the salt off if you want to do that for some canned goods. You know, in the heat of the moment, I talk about the Food-Wise override, which is, you know, the S now becomes sane. So we have to make sane choices. And so what that father of two is trying to balance is, you know, again, time and money. And so you might, you know, he might be bringing home something from some fast food place, hoping that the kids are going to eat it that night. And in the book, I talk about how You know, if I've got like a hot dog stand, I might, you know, I'll go for the hot dog and with a lot of sauerkraut, fermented vegetables, even though it's kind of industrial.
So if you have impressionable young minds in the household who also care about animals and are trying to have a different diet than the mainstream, whether it be vegan or vegetarian, what are some of the guidelines that you would push in order to kind of get that really valuable protein? Because we've had some guests on here on Sea Change Radio who've talked about the real dangers of a monoculture where we're just pumping soy into our meat alternatives in order to just boost the protein levels, but that's not necessarily good for people, and it's not necessarily good for the soil to be growing so much corn and soy.
Well, on the question of soy, I couldn't agree more. I think there's two parts to that. One is, how do you know what you know? I mean, how do you know what to do? And then the other question is, what do you do? And the book really addresses the how piece. And so what I would urge young people, this is why I wrote the book, for students, because of their fierce food beliefs. So in the book, I talk about fierce food beliefs. And originally, the book was going to be only on that, fierce food beliefs and how to address them. But my response is, my advice is follow the money, follow the story. Who are the winners? Who are the losers? If you've got questions about fat in your diet, look at how saturated fat first became demonized. Who was behind that? What was the industry behind it? What did they have to gain? And I trace some of that in the book. So I guess I would just advise people to be as critical as possible. What does processed fat get us? And who's behind that? And so that's kind of the how. But in terms of guidelines, the guidelines in the book are choose whole, be informed, choose sustainable, and go for the experience. Experiment for yourself. And I guess in terms of the example that you gave of the saturated fat and the animals, I think as we look at animal sources of protein and animal sources of fat, it's important to look at sustainable and whole systems of production, and they exist. Even systems of production that are able to cycle carbon better in terms of greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, the book is Food Wise. The author is Gigi Berardi. Gigi, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Charles Erland, Ricky Lee Jones, and the Blind Boys of Alabama. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.